All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuckstables, what the fuck-a-philiacs? Who's on the show? Dave Ross is on the show. Funny guy. Used to do a Sex Nerd Sandra podcast, but, you know, I've worked with him a few times. He used to run a show downtown, and I was happy to talk to him, so that's coming up. Tomorrow night at the Tripany House. Tomorrow night is the 11th. It's a Tuesday. And then the following Tuesday is the 18th. I'm going to do a couple more shows if you want to come. I think there's probably tickets at trippinghouse.org. I don't know. I ran the new hour. I ran it in New York. I ran it for the people. Thank you for coming to the Skirball Center, selling out two shows. Felt good. It felt great. I felt weird before. It's so bizarre to me how much preparation I can do and working through new material and trying to structure things and trying to put it together. And then I get up there and I just want to make it real, man. I just want to get in the present. I want to feel some awkward pauses. I want to get some big laughs, but I want there to be some weird lulls where I just know that I'm on stage alone, breathing, holding a cup of water perched on a stool. Sometimes I just want to feel that. I don't know how that plays necessarily. It was good, though. It was very nice. I really thank you for coming. And you know, I had a good time. Chris Garcia opened for me. It was great. Let's walk through the New York experience because I had a couple of interesting moments. Some of you may have seen me on the Today Show. I'm sorry I didn't tell you previous. Sometimes I forget these things. I don't prioritize it in my head that you should get up and watch the Today Show. I wasn't even sure why I was doing the Today Show, but it was odd. It was an interesting time. If you want to go do a little research, you can. I'm sure you can find my segment on the Today Show from last Friday. I was a little out of sorts in New York because I just was. I've been waffling, man. I've been waffling in my sense of what the hell's going on. I sometimes I don't know whose life I'm living. Sometimes I'm just walking down the street and I'm like this guy in a 51-year-old body going like, how'd we get here, man? This is crazy. Look, you're a walking, talking, grown-ass man with ideas and thoughts who seems to be having a career of some kind. How did that happen? Who is in charge of that? What where are we at? It's almost like this guy inside of me has been sleeping or he's just been in a box for the last, you know, 30 years. And he's like, what? Wow. Things have really changed since you locked me in that room. Who the hell knows when you locked that guy in that room? So that's how I was feeling. I was a little like of two selves. And one self was sort of in reality. The other one was like struggling to hold on to, you know, what I assume is my perception of things. And I knew I had to go do the Today Show, but I knew that it was only going to be 4 minutes. And I knew that there was three hosts. This woman, Tamron, this guy, Willie, Al Roker, who I've met before once or twice. I knew I was going to enter that weird, you know, amplified, it's not surreal, but it's sort of hyper real. It's definitely like, here we go. We're on the ride. I knew that was going to happen, man. I knew going in. And I didn't know if I could adjust to it because I knew that they were all three going to be asking me questions. I had 4 minutes. And if I wanted to get anything out that made any sense, I was just going to have to, you know, get into that moment and just, you know, kind of push it out there. And, you know, you get to the studio. It's all very by rote over there. They've got a machine going and, you know, you're just, you know, a temporary moving part into the kind of like frenetic machine that goes into keeping eyes on the tube. In the morning, heading to work, I got out there. They brought me out. They sat me down. There's Al Roker's head right next to mine. There's hello, Al Roker's head, is what my brain is thinking. There's this guy, Willie, who I had just met previous. We had a little conversation. And then there's this woman, Tamron. And then I just, you know, they introduced me and I just flew off the handle right out of the gate. Things got weird with me and that woman. And it was not a bad weird. It was an interesting weird. Al was laughing. That guy, Willie, threw me a curveball with some drug question. Didn't know quite know where to go with it. Didn't know how much we could do on the Today Show. Followed my heart. Followed my rage. Followed my charm into a kind of a happy mess of a Today Show segment. I think Al Roker had a very good time. I think that there's a moment when you deal with TV personalities, you know, where you know, once the cameras go on, you got this one thing. And then when they're off, you got that one thing, but there's another thing trying to get out. There's another thing, like, I think that all people who are on television that have to operate at a certain frequency, just below that frequency is someone going like, please, just get us out of here for a few minutes. Please, can you just get us out of here for a few minutes? Please, we can't do it, but you can do it. And I feel like that was the energy was driving me. I feel like in somewhere in my heart and in my mind that Al and Willie and Tamron were like, please do something, make something happen. Could somebody make something happen here? Because I don't know if I'm alive right now. Maybe I'm projecting. But we all had a pretty good time. And my mother enjoyed the segment. And I got some good feedback. It's nice when my mommy can enjoy something I do. And so that was that. I did that in the morning. I did Opie and Jim. It was good to see Jim. It was good to see Opie. That was fun. So what else happened? Okay, so I do the two shows at Skirball. They were great. Had a good time. Ate a lot of food in New York. Too much food. Was at the Bowery Hotel. Was in an elevator with Jimmy Page. I know I got a lot of elevator stories, but this was one of those ones that took me off. It was off guard. I was in the elevator. Some people walked in, and then the door opened again, and another guy walks in with a gray ponytail, and these people all know each other, and I'm like, holy fuck, that's Jimmy Page. That's Jimmy Page right there. Right there. The guy that blows minds for eternity with his music. Forever. Those riffs will be as huge as they are. So I didn't say nothing. I looked at the side of his head. I looked at his flat, weird face. I looked at his gray ponytail. And I tried to mentally extract some guitar wisdom from that massive mind of Jimmy Page. And but you know what? He's pretty well protected mystically. I felt a wall. You know, I sent my feelers out there. I let the little kid in the box hold the vessel together as I sort of slightly astral projected into Jimmy Page's ear to try to work some stuff out, to try to pull some stuff out of there. Not steal it, but just sort of, you know, take anything that's left over. But he was very well protected. Could not glean it. Did not happen. What, Pauly Shore? What are you doing here?
You told me to come by.
Don't play along.
Okay.
Wait, what are you in the neighborhood?
Yeah, I was down the street.
Yeah,
I was down by Chris D'Elia's.
Yeah, wait, did you Chris live over here?
No, he was at Intelligentsia Cafe.
Oh, over in Silver Lake?
Yeah.
Oh, you moved to Silver Lake, huh?
Yeah, I moved to Silver Lake.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I live in a fourplex.
Really?
Yeah.
What the fuck what is a fourplex?
Fourplex is, it's one building.
Yeah.
And it's got four apartments in it.
So,
two girls live below me, and then a dude with a hairpiece lives next to me.
Is that what you call him?
He's an attorney, and he's got a hairpiece. Every time I'm like doing my laundry,
yeah,
I look over, and there's a styrofoam head, and it's got like a hairpiece on it. It reminds me of my father.
Really?
Yeah, because my dad wears a hairpiece.
There was a comic, I can't remember his name. He used to travel with like three or four different ones. So he'd travel with three or four styrofoam heads, and he'd ask you like, which one do you think I should do? And you'd have to, you know, chime in.
It's one of those hair pieces that are so, you know, I mean, it looks like a hair piece. Yeah, when he walks around. But it's cool. He's a sweet, he's like an attorney guy. He's, I guess, newly divorced, and he's living in one of those.
Newly divorced with a hair piece, living alone.
Living in a fourplex.
Next to Pauly Shore.
Yeah.
That's a sad story
He's gemmed up to me a lot, though, lately.
Yeah,
Sweeter. Like, you know, like at first he was looking at me kind of like stern.
Yeah.
Like standoffish, and now it's like sweet eyes. Like not gay sweet eyes, but,
no,
it's
but
like nice.
Like help me.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And then I have a girl that lives below me, and she actually wrote me a letter, and this is true. This was like when I first moved into it. She wrote me a letter and she left it on my door. She goes, if you're gonna have sex, you know, please shut the windows and turn on the air conditioning because the walls are paper thin. And she says, if I have sex, I'll do the same for you.
Really?
Yeah.
So whoever lived there before obviously set some sort of weird standard.
Yeah.
Just some screaming maniac who had no respect for the neighbors.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Did you write back and say, like, no need to do it on your end?
Yeah. No, I apologize. I would say I kind of embarrassing, you know what I mean? Because sometimes, you know, you get girls that are like vocal.
But was it after did you feel like she had heard something?
She did hear something because it was the night after I had sex with a girl.
Oh,
yeah.
Are you loud?
I'm not loud, but the girl was.
Okay.
You know, some girls are loud, some girls are not loud.
You don't say anything? You don't make any noises? I mean...
Yeah, well, sometimes. Nah, when you're older, it's not as loud. Yeah. It's like... It's a little, the orgasm is a little
I'm
loud.
Very loud, and I don't even know that I'm doing it, really? But I'm like, God damn it!
Right,
loud.
Right.
I don't even know why, it just happens. I was hoping you'd say some like sort of signature, you know, Pauly thing when you came. That would be.
But yeah, it's cool. It's cool living out there. You know, I never, you know, like this area is like, it's cool because it reminds, I feel like an American now. I feel like...
What does that mean? You're living in Hollywood.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, my whole life, I've lived in the city. So, like, most Americans...
Silver Lake's the country. You're out here in the Midwest of Silver Lake, huh?
No, but a lot of Americans, what they do is they work in the city, and then they drive home to the suburb. Mm-hmm. So you work at the store. You come in. You do your show. You do your whatever. And then you come here. It's very peaceful.
Yeah,
so
it's true.
I feel like when I drive down Fountain, you know, and I'm cruising 20 minutes.
It's nice, right?
Yeah, it's great, dude. I feel like very peaceful. Like, yeah, it's nice.
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah, because
that's what America does.
Sure. And when I first moved out here, I thought like, oh my God, where the fuck do I live? But now I'm like, thank God.
No, it's nice.
It's great because you can shoot right down Fountain, and over Silver Lake's nice, and over here is nice. But I listened to the podcast that you did with Dice.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know, man. It seems like you've sort of, you know, locked into something. Like, it's a very interesting format. You've got Pauly Shore's Interested podcast is unlike any other podcast, because I did it, and when he told me to do it, I was like, this is a little fucking weird. You're like, I want you to talk about Lenny Bruce, but I'm going to talk to Kitty Bruce, and then who's Lenny's daughter, and then when you're talking about Lenny Bruce, I'll play you what she said, and you can react to that. So you're almost like facilitating a conversation between two people that can't really respond to each other.
Right.
But it has an interesting effect to it. How'd you come up with that?
Well, you've been so successful with this format, and you've kind of, you know, been the first of it, and it's kind of like, we even talked about, like, this is where the business is. I mean, everyone's got a podcast now. It's like, I just wanted to try to do something that was different.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I wanted to try to come up with something that hadn't been done before. So I was talking to my agents, and we're just, you know, I just riffing, you know, riffing and talking and, you know, coming up with it. And then we started talking about, like, interviewing someone and then someone commenting on it. And it's almost kind of like, most of the people that I interview are knowledgeable about the person that I'm interviewing.
Uh-huh.
So that's why, like...
So that was the idea.
Yeah, because, like...
Or at least about the person that you're interviewing that other person about. Because, I mean, you interviewed Rodney Dangerfield's wife.
Yeah.
And then, like, Dice was commenting on Rodney.
Yeah.
But the thing that was cool about it, it was like, Dice was almost exclusively commenting on Rodney. So it wasn't weird kind of Dice stuff. It was like... thoughtful and about something that you know, both of them related to, that I can relate to.
A lot of people that are comedy fans, you go back, like, a lot of people don't know Rodney Dangerfield gave Andrew Dice Clay his start.
Right, on and the special.
Yeah, on the Young Comedian special on HBO. And Sam was on it, and there was a couple other guys on it, Dom and Bob Nelson, I guess, was on it, Roseanne. And I just kind of wanted to bring people back to that time, you know. And Rodney is like, it's like, you know, he's, I don't want to say he's forgotten, but
he doesn't get the respect,
right?
Oddly.
Yeah. No, but he's so fucking funny, dude.
He's the greatest.
He was like,
the greatest.
Yeah, he, excuse me, his one-liners were just like...
No, he was great. Yeah, it is very ironic and weird that he does not get the respect that he deserves. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why either. So who else have you had on, and what was the pairings that are up now?
Yeah, well, this week was I interviewed Carrot Top, and then Larry the Cable Guy comments. And what we find out is that they both started together in West Palm Beach, Florida, in 86.
Where'd you find Dan? Does he live out here?
No, he was filming a Prilosec commercial in L.A., and I told him that I, you know, because I asked Carrot Top, I'm like, who do you want me to comment on yours? And he gave me a couple people, a list of people, and he said, Larry the Cable Guy. And I'm like, oh, I'm friends with him. I'll reach out to him. And I just happened to get him in town
that
week. So he was
How's he doing?
He's great. He's a sweet guy.
So it's Dan talking about Carrot Top, intercut with Carrot Top talking about Carrot Top.
Yeah.
And they started in the same place.
Yeah, they started in Palm Beach.
I remember when Dan Whitney, and he was working at the store.
Yeah.
Don't you?
He didn't
work much. It was like Belly Room. I don't know if he was even a regular.
Yeah. He's done so well with that whole redneck thing.
I would say
it's
so.
Like, fuck, dude.
Yeah.
And he's a sweet guy.
Yeah. Who else you got up?
I had one coming up. I have Kitty Bruce and Mark Maron.
Oh, that's a good
comments
one. That was so nice. You sent me that email, the voicemail from Kitty.
Yeah.
I don't even remember how that went. I remember I was being sort of like, I'm not I don't know everything, but, you know.
It was cool because, you know, for me, like, I always think of the listener and you know, like, having you on was a big deal for me to have you on. Not just because we're friends in the store and stuff like that, but just because you know a lot of shit. And a lot of people don't know Lenny Bruce.
Right. It's hard.
They just don't. You know what I mean? And the cool part about, I think, your interview with the Kitty Bruce is it's not about you.
Yeah.
It's about Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
And so I really got a big education about who Lenny Bruce was. And I think your audience and my audience are going to learn that Lenny Bruce was, I mean, you want to tell him who the fuck he was, dude?
Right. Well, it's hard, like, to put him into context. Yeah. I mean, that's the trickiest thing, is everybody knows the name. Mm-hmm. They know the idea. They get a sort of a sense that he was important in the sort of freedom of speech thing. Mm-hmm. But to really kind of sit down and talk about, you know, those records and what they were at the time and why he was important. And also the fact that, like, you know, a lot of stuff he talked in Yiddish sometimes. Mm, and
he had a cadence.
Yeah, oh, definitely had a rhythm.
But also, like, you watch a Scorsese film or a Tarantino film, like, it's timeless.
Yeah.
Like, those films are timeless. Right. And Lenny Bruce is timeless.
Some of it.
So if you just watched him, he's just like one of these guys. So I just thought, you know, interviewing him and having you comment on that was like a really
Kitty,
cool.
I'm looking forward to hearing it because I'd like to hear Kitty talk.
Yeah, because she wouldn't let me air it. You know, because at first, because, you know, I got these photos of you guys.
Yeah.
You know, I got, like, images to put it on iTunes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I want to put it on. She's like, oh, let me hear it first.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, because
so that was so very, that voicemail you sent me was her signing off on it?
Yeah, signing off on it.
Oh,
yeah.
That's cool.
So it was really, yeah.
Yours. How many are up?
I have so far about, I'd have to say 10. We have the Robin Williams one is really good, too. I like the Robin Williams one.
That's up there?
That's up there. That's where I interview Rick Overton and Ed Begley Jr. comments, which is really cool because you learn a lot about Ed Begley Jr. because I
know it's great.
He's so good.
He's
dude.
So great, man.
Yeah, he's awesome.
I've had him in here. It's crazy.
He is so. I mean, who
you
knew
would
that
never
he
imagine.
Did? I didn't know he was doing heroin with John Belushi.
I know, it's crazy.
It's like Ed Begley Jr., Mr. Environmental guy.
Yeah, he ended up at the Manson House once.
Yeah,
I got a lot of weird shit.
And you know, I have a lot of people. So
cool,
yeah,
man. So, now tell me about this. The Showtime, the documentary, Pauly Shore Stands Alone. Is this what I saw you working on, like, last year?
Editing it, you mean?
No, I don't know.
Was I wasn't. You didn't see me film it.
What was that song you were closing with for
oh, me? No.
Okay.
That was like the political thing.
Oh, yeah.
That was probably political. No, this is just a straight documentary. This is something that I shot in the Midwest. It's kind of like this smaller tour. I'm playing these kind of obscure markets, like Antigo, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I'm playing, you know, in the middle of the dead of winter.
Yeah.
And I'm at the same time moving my mom out of her house of 40 years and trying to get her situated.
She's in it?
Well, just the real of me trying to. I mean, your parents, are they still around?
Yeah.
So do you ever deal with, are they elderly?
Yeah, but not that old yet. Okay. They both have significant others around, too.
Okay, but at some point, you're going to be called to do things.
I hope they don't call me.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so
I do.
I'm just like, you know, you have to, you want to kind of do it right. You know, I had to move her out of the house. And
but is,
so
is all that she, stuff, is she in the doctor?
I don't want to say. I don't want to say because I don't want people to, you know what I mean? I don't want to, like, I'd rather have people see it.
Okay.
You know, because I don't want to, because it's something special that happens at the end.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's cool.
Well, now I got to watch it.
Yeah, so.
How's she doing?
She's got Parkinson's, and when you have Parkinson's and you have good help, you can live for a long time. So okay. She'll be around for a long time.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And do you still enjoy her company?
It's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough. Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, it's hard, you know?
It's sad.
Yeah, dude, I did a show in, you're going to love this. I did a show in, where was it? A Woodstock. Uh-huh. I was there a couple weeks ago, and Danny Stone came to my show.
Oh, no.
Yeah, dude. How
hey,
awesome
how
is
are
that?
You? What's going on?
But he's in, like, disability. He lives up in Woodstock.
Is he all sweaty and weird? And can't look at
I didn't
you
see
and...
him. He wouldn't hang out till I got off stage. And then I'm like, dude, where the fuck did you go, dude? What happened was, is before I go on stage, you know, before you do a show, everyone's like, oh, blah, blah, blah's here. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. You know, so they said, oh, Danny Stone's here. Do you want him to come up? And uh-huh. I'm like, no.
Danny Stone used to date your mom back in, like, when I was there.
Yeah. So I said, no, I don't want to see him. You know, I don't want to see him before my show. Yeah, I just kind of, I don't like to see people. Yeah. So I'm about to go on. So then after I finish, the first person I want to see is who?
Danny Stone.
Danny Stone. Sure. I want to see him, you know? And I asked the person, and they're like, he's gone. So he didn't hang out. He didn't hang out with me. And then he called me in my office like a week later. He's like, oh, I couldn't hang out. I had to get out of there.
Oh, really?
I'm like, oh, that sucks.
Well, he maybe something triggered or something.
He says there's too many people and he felt uncomfortable. Oh, he's got a cane and stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, because he did so much coke, dude. He's fucked up.
Is that it?
Back then. Yeah.
I didn't know you could fuck up your legs on coke.
Well,
no,
I don't know.
He probably has something else wrong with him.
He's got some stenosis.
Some... I don't
know what that
is. Oh, my God. All right, let's get back to this. So the documentary premieres December 4th at 8 p.m. on Showtime.
Yeah.
They're going to run it a few times. I'm excited. So it'll come out good?
Yeah, I'm liking it. I'm having it pretty cool, exciting. It's going to be on. Also, we're doing an L.A. premiere at the Comedy Store November 12th.
Uh-huh.
So,
really?
Yeah. So if you're around next Wednesday, Wednesday.
I think I will be around.
Yeah, we're doing it at 8:30.
In the main room?
In the main room. We already have like about 250 RSVPs.
Oh, that's great.
So
man.
Gary Shanley said he's coming and a lot of people are going to come.
Oh, that's cool, man.
Yeah. So.
Well, you know what? I'm happy you're doing all this stuff, man. I'm rooting for you, Pauly.
Well, you know, we root for each other at this point. It's kind of like the little engine that could, you know?
Again.
You just got to keep going, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I always like seeing you. Thanks for coming by.
Right, thanks, guys.
Well, that was wild, right? Pauly Shore just stopping by. Surprised me. Pauly Shore's Interested is available on iTunes and at paulyshore.com. The episode with me, Mark Maron, on it is out this Wednesday, November 12th. And the new documentary, Pauly Shore Stands Alone, premieres on Showtime December 4th. I've grown to like that boy as time has gone on. You know? Before I was interrupted by Pauly, where was I? I was in New York. Took the train Saturday morning up to Boston, the Acela. And that night we did Comics Come Home. At the Boston Garden. Boston Garden, are you fucking kidding me? It was amazing. The Cam Neely Foundation raised a bunch of money. There was like 12,000 people there. It's Dennis Leary sing. And I didn't realize it, but I did the first one, and this was the 20th anniversary. I was on the first one of these things. I did two early on, and this was like my return. But what a fucking bill, man. Dennis looked great. He had some good shit. And Lenny Clark was there. I go back with Lenny. You know, I started in Boston, so a lot of these cats, you know, I hadn't seen, but I've seen over the years. But there was one dude there, Joe Iannetti. Joe Iannetti is this comic from Boston who I literally did open mics with when I was in college. And I hadn't seen him in almost 30 years. And it was great. It was like I was blown away. I almost cried. He just kicked throat cancer. He looks great. And Tony V was there. Adam Roth was on guitar. Hadn't seen him in a while. Robert Kelly fucking killed. Bill Burr closed it out. He was amazing. Jimmy Fallon showed up. Gaffigan was there. It was so weird when you're around people that you knew when you were a kid. You know how you sort of feel like a kid and you kind of act like a kid. I mean, fucking Lenny Clark, his brother Mike Clark, whose phone number I still remember because he used to book rooms. Oh, my God. And there, you know, it was just great. Some of them have kids now. You know, we're old guys, and everybody's got something going on. Life doesn't get any easier necessarily as you get older. But it was very moving, and it was a great time. And Cam Neely was great, and I hope they raised some money. I met all the Boston Bruins, and I got to be honest with you. I don't know fucking anything about hockey, but I was excited to meet the Bruins. They all looked like they were 12. They were beat up 12. Yeah, but they're like kids. It was mind-blowing. And Dennis had said to me, it was funny because Dennis is a hockey fan. He says, you know, I'm running up to these guys. And I'm like, oh, my God, you're the guy. I love it. And he's like, they're kids. I'm acting like some weird old man. Oh, man. All right. Do I sound too happy? It was fun, right? All right. Let's talk to Dave Ross. So where the fuck did you come from, Dave Ross? I mean, what, you know, like I know you from
Holy Fuck.
No, from Holy Fuck, but also you used to be a sidekick on the sex nerd Sandra.
Yeah, sex nerd
you,
Sandra.
You were like the male balance. You were the Adam Carolla of that situation.
Sure, sure. The Adam Carolla and the... Yeah, you're right. That's exactly what I was. I was like the dumb, regular, funny
dude.
Guy. Dude. Right.
Right. And now you've got your own podcast?
Yes.
Called
Terrified.
What's the angle?
I interview people about either what they're afraid of or what they don't like about themselves.
Why is everyone doing my show? Everyone's doing their own version of my show.
You know, that wasn't the intention.
I'm kidding. Don't get nervous.
No, that was the intention.
I know. No, I'm glad that the doors are open and then everyone's finding their portal into the heads of others.
Oh, yeah.
So how long have you been in L.A.?
I've been in L.A. a long time. I mean, there was a two-year gap at the beginning where I was in Fresno, but I moved here in 2000 when I was 17 to go to college.
Oh.
Yeah.
From where?
From New York, upstate New York.
You're an upstate New York guy?
Yeah, like an hour north, Orange County, New York.
That's a lie. There's no Orange County,
there is.
New York.
Orange County Choppers, man. That's where they're from.
I don't even know what they are.
They make motorcycles. I don't fucking know.
Oh, they're a motorcycle? That's the big business?
They had a show.
American-made motorcycles?
Yeah. There was a show on the Discovery Channel called American Chopper.
What, those the family?
Yeah.
Oh, with the dude with the big mustache?
Yeah, and their company is called the Orange County Choppers, and that's where I'm from. I'm from right around there.
They're up there?
Yeah.
I like those guys.
Yeah, they're funny. Yeah.
Yeah. There's always
funny,
a problem
bitchy
between,
dudes.
Yeah, between the father and son. Then there's the one simpler son.
Yeah, who just like made stuff.
What's the big city?
Oh, there isn't really. Newburgh?
Newburgh.
Do you know Newburgh?
No.
Newburgh and Middletown. You know, it's really close to New Paltz.
Yeah.
And I would go to a lot of shows, a lot of punk shows in Poughkeepsie.
Were you a musician?
No, just a fan.
Just a punk?
Just a punk kid.
Punk kid?
Yeah.
How old are you?
I'm 31.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, what kind of fucking life experience do you have?
I fucking knew it, man. I knew you were going to ask me that. I knew I was going to come on your show and you'd be like, who the fuck are you?
Uh-huh.
Why are you even here?
Yeah.
I knew
so
it.
So explain yourself.
Well, you tell me. You fucking asked me to come.
Oh, boy. Any tension right out of the gate? No, I think you were pitched to me by my former assistant, Sam. And I'm like, yeah, that guy's funny. Let's figure out what he's about.
Because
you're like one of the funnier guys that's on the scene now. One of the funny young comedians here in Los Angeles. But I don't have much experience with you personally.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But upstate New York, that sounds interesting. So what were you doing? Like, what kind of family you come from?
My dad, you know, actually, it's funny. I'm already backtracking. Yeah. I'm not even really from upstate New York.
Yeah.
My dad was in the Navy my whole life.
Really?
Yeah. So we moved. I was born in Hawaii. Then we moved every 3 years until he retired. Then we moved to Orange County, New York. And my dad taught ROTC at a high school. And I was just there for eighth grade in high school.
Oh, my God. So what was his highest rank in the Navy?
He got to commander.
What's that equivalent to in the regular?
It's right below captain. So I think it's like
sergeant?
Two below admiral, which is the same as general
mm-hmm.
in the army.
Right.
Yeah. So it would have been, he would have been captain and then admiral and then two-star admiral.
So you grew up on bases?
No. And it's actually like kind of, you know, they had the right thought, but I think that it was, in retrospect, bad for me. I wasn't raised on bases. Everywhere that we moved, we would live off base and I would go to a regular public school because mm-hmm. they wanted me to have a regular upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
But looking back,
I talked to somebody else who had that same experience.
Really?
Wanda Sykes.
Mm-hmm. No way.
Her dad was a big shot and they never lived on bases and they, you know, for similar reasons. So why was it a mistake?
Well, like, I'm glad that I went to public schools and stuff so I know what it's like, but it probably would have been a little more beneficial to be on bases with other kids who moved around a lot so I would have people to talk to that I could relate to about my life.
Yeah.
Instead of like, I would just show up in a town and they'd be like, who the fuck are you?
Who's the new kid?
Yeah. I'm always the new kid.
Yeah.
And I'm like afraid, you know,
yeah.
everywhere I go.
So you're isolated? So yeah. How'd you end up making friends?
Nope.
Sad.
Didn't really.
Really?
And
do you have siblings?
No.
You're an only child?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, man.
It's a lot of pressure.
It was a lot of pressure.
I always think that, I don't know why, I've asked every only child I've ever talked to, like, didn't it seem like a lot of pressure to not die?
Yeah. Well, maybe you've gotten this from only children, too. a lot of only children I talk to have a real, like a distant relationship with their parents.
Really?
Yeah, and it's like a weird phenomenon that none of us understand. I certainly don't.
Well, what do you think it could be?
I think, like...
Well, your dad's in the military.
There's that.
Yeah.
My dad's a real dad, too. He's a real, how's the car? Here's your mother, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the last time, not the last time I was home, but two times ago, I was there for the longest I'd been there for like a week. And normally I'm only there for a day or two. And on the fourth or fifth day, I was eating dinner with them. And my mom was like, so David, how, she started asking me a question.
Yeah.
And my dad reached his hand over and like touched her arm and was like, Bretta. And she goes, oh. And I was like, what? What was that?
Yeah.
And she goes, she's like, oh, well, I mean, I don't want to smother you. And I was like, what? What do you mean? And she's like, I don't want to pry into your life. I can be too motherly, you know? And I was like, you don't even call me on my birthday.
Wow.
Which is true. And
so lucky you stayed the week.
Right?
Yeah, because it got to boiling point.
Yeah.
So you had this weird moment?
Yeah, it was a weird moment in which I was like, you know, I tell you every year to call me more. I call you and they don't call me back. And it was like the first, I always thought.
And you're
like,
their only child.
It's my only child, yeah. Huh. I have a joke about this too. My mother had a series of miscarriages before I was born too. So I'm also like the one that made it, you know?
Yeah,
yeah. So it's interesting to me. It boggles my mind.
Well, what came of that moment?
I was just like, no, smother me, please. Yeah, yeah. Call me more. I would love to hear from you. Yeah. I don't talk to you enough.
Yeah.
We have an odd distance and I don't. And they're like, oh, okay, fine. And then it just continued as such.
The distance?
Yeah.
I don't know what to make of that.
Me neither. And I have that joke about it. So every now and then I'll do that joke on stage and someone will come up to me after the show and be like, I'm an only child and I never talk to my parents and it bothers me to death. And thank you for talking about that because I feel it makes me feel awful.
but did that person tell you it was on their choice? Like they just don't call that person or you didn't get any more backstory?
No, I mean, I talked to someone in St. Louis actually at length, maybe it was Kansas City. They were like, yeah, no, I'm an only child and I was with them every single day of my life until I was 18 and I moved out and they never call and I call them and they don't call me back and I feel the distance and so maybe I don't call them as much as I would but they literally never call and I see them once every 2 years.
Oh my God.
It's weird. Yeah.
So it's a real phenomenon.
Yeah.
And you haven't been able to figure it out.
I mean, I certainly contribute. You know, I don't want to sit here and say my parents are like awful parents or something.
No, I know, but it's like, I mean, obviously as we get older, their distance happens, but this seems to be like a real phenomenon that only children feel a weird detachment. I wonder what the hell that is. I can't even fucking work the math on it.
I think, the first real insight I had into it was when my mother said she didn't want to smother me.
Yeah.
Because then that makes me think maybe at every, and she has said a few things since just in passing, like, well, I'm always wondering about you. And so I think maybe my mom is so neurotic and so like just so turned so inward at her own anxiety that she's afraid of calling me too much. And she overcompensates for her worry of calling me too much by calling me not at all.
Well, it seems like if you're an only child, there is the concern that, you know, you're going to be isolated. It's going to be hard for you to make friends or something.
Yes.
And they, you know, and they know that, you know, most of your life, they've been your primary, you know, you don't have a sibling. So they've kind of worn the shoes of that too.
Sure.
So I think there's a concern that there's a natural concern that you're going to be too attached.
Sure.
As an only child, maybe.
Sure. There's that. And then I think you combine that with the fact, like what you just said, is you have to make your own way socially. You don't have other age mates in your family teaching you how to do things.
Right.
So in school, you're also, you know, a fish out of water.
Freak.
Yeah, totally. You're like a, and then you combine, if you're at all a thoughtful person, you're like yelling at yourself that you're a loser all day.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And so, I don't know.
Right, because you can't, you're detached from everybody.
Exactly.
I don't know what the stigma, why is there a stigma to only child to other kids? Because I feel it, but I wonder what it is.
You know, I didn't know it until I became a comedian, and comedians are very vocal about how they hate only children.
They are?
Yeah, like the comics I know. And
I've never heard a joke like that.
Really?
Huh.
Like, I don't know. I haven't heard
this
it on
new
stage.
Generation beating up on the only children,
not respecting the
like
only
what?
Children. Well, not on stage, but I've had a bunch of comics in particular tell me, "You're not like the other only children." I'll say I'm an only child on stage, and they come up to me after my set and be like, "Wow, I never would have guessed. Only children are assholes."
Really?
And I think it's because, like, people talk to me about only children.
They think you're
children,
spoiled?
Like, yeah, self-obsessed. Everything's about you.
Uh-huh.
Everyone has to listen to
you. That's comedians.
I agree.
Yeah. How are they able to decipher those symptoms from just their own bullshit?
Yeah.
I guess that is true. That's the stigma. It's like you're precious. You know, you're treated like he's our only one.
Right. Right. You get all the attention at Christmas.
Yeah.
The birthday is all about you. Yeah.
And no friends. Just you and your parents.
Exactly. It is weird to think about. Also, moving,
mm-hmm.
it, like, every 3 years, I would just be like, all right, well, it's just mom and dad and me again. Let's see what happens.
No brother to bounce off of or beat the shit out of.
No.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, wait, so you lived in Hawaii?
Very briefly, for 3 months.
Now, what's the social background? Ross, is that Jewish?
No, that's not Jewish.
It's non-Jewish Ross.
Non-Jewish Ross. Uh-huh. I Scottish. It's a Scottish clan and county in Scotland. It's like a clan of cowards.
Hmm? Oh, you looked it up?
I looked. Oh, yeah. No, I really. I don't know enough about my heritage. I'm really interested in it. I want to know. Probably because the name dies with me. You know.
Well, there's other Rosses. No, don't you have cousins?
I do have cousins, but they're all mostly. From
mother's side?
My dad has two sisters and two brothers. Uh-huh. And the cousins that are my age are from his sisters. So.
Did you ever ask him why they only had one kid?
I know because of the miscarriages. I didn't want to have that conversation.
Right. That's true. They obviously tried.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually think that I'm pretty sure that I was a mistake. Because I think the miscarriages were like years before me.
And they were like, we're done.
And my parents, when I look in their medicine cabinet in their house, like you do, they have condoms.
Yeah.
Did
you grow up Catholic?
No.
No?
I mean,
just military?
Military. And my parents still say grace and stuff, but I didn't ever have to go to church.
Did you know your grandparents and everything?
Mm-hmm.
So your dad, Scottish background.
My dad was raised Catholic and my mother was raised Lutheran, and I was actually baptized in both of those faiths, and neither grandmother was told about the other one, just to appease both grandmothers.
So the whole thing was just to appease the grandparents.
Yeah, totally.
But what's the Scottish city of cowards? That sounds interesting.
Well, like, have you ever seen Braveheart?
Mm-hmm.
There's a line in Braveheart where they say something like, I can't believe that's what I'm referencing. One of the characters is like, we'll run, hide, the Highland way. And I looked it up, and that's an actual trope. Like, the history of Highland Scots is they ran up into the hills when they got attacked, and that's why they're still alive, and the Ross is a Highland clan.
Wow.
Yeah.
You come from a tradition of cowards.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It is, and it makes sense to me.
Have you been to Scotland?
I have when I was a kid.
Your folks went there?
We lived in Italy from when I was 3 till when I was 6.
You remember that? That must have been nice.
I remember it briefly. No, it wasn't really nice.
No?
Well, I mean, yeah, it was tough. It was,
Because you didn't speak the language?
I spoke the language a tiny bit.
Yeah.
But I was raised in an English, like, we lived in an English-speaking part of Italy. Like, so my dad worked on a U.S. Navy base that was attached to a NATO base, and he worked with NASA. Like, we hung out with a lot of astronauts.
Really?
Yeah. And I...
Like, famous astronauts?
Kathy Sullivan was
uh-huh.
one of them.
Uh-huh.
She was a really good friend of my dad's.
And, she's a shuttle astronaut?
She was the first woman to spacewalk.
Free floating?
Free floating, yeah. I think a shuttle. I think she was a shuttle astronaut.
What do you talk about with astronauts? So space, right?
Yeah, right, yeah. So
that's
cool.
That's got to be crazy.
Heavy, man. Yeah.
How fast did you go in the rocket?
So, like, is that ice cream real?
Yeah.
Do you
in
eat
the
that?
Bag? It's not real ice cream.
Come on, man. Really?
Yeah. Do you remember her?
I do. She was really nice. But I was really young.
Yeah.
And I do remember I was allowed into the building my dad worked in, but my mother wasn't. And
you were no threat. That kid's not going to remember anything.
I couldn't read. That's why. And when I learned to read, I wasn't allowed in there.
What building was that? The NATO, NASA?
I don't know.
Naval Matrix?
Right?
Yeah.
It's a little freaky. My dad, I haven't asked him, but he also hasn't told me what he did there. So I like to assume that it was aliens.
You know, ask your dad about that. Like, you know, why can't you tell me?
No, I never think of it.
Well, how were you raised?
I'm too busy wondering if he's mad at me.
Really? That's your life? What did I do wrong now?
Yeah, totally.
Why is he mad at me? Well, what was the hope, man? What were you studying when you were like, what was your interest when you were in high school and shit?
When I was in high school,
Other than punk rock.
Yeah, well, I went to punk shows and I did theater. That's what I did. That was my life in high school.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So did your dad ever voice some concern?
Yeah, they were pretty cool. They were into that I was an actor, and I did really well in school.
Yeah.
So I also would, you know, say like maybe I'll go to engineering school. And then my dad had a recruiter come to the house once to see if I would join the Navy.
Oh, how was that conversation?
I mean, I was like, dude, He had him come to the house. Yeah. And I was like, I'm not gonna join.
You're not gonna get me.
Yeah.
This ain't gonna go.
And he was like, well, think about it. And I was like, all right. And he handed me some pamphlets. And I was like, I'll think about it.
You never thought of
it. I didn't think about it a single time. Yeah.
Did you go, you never had that confrontation with your father about what you want to do? He was that detached? Did he wear his uniform at dinner?
No, but high school was really rough. It was like, it wasn't, my relationship with my dad is, I love my dad, but it is a little contentious some of the time because he's irritable. And I don't think either of us really completely got over high school because I was very like emotional in high school and he was not happy. So there was a lot of screaming and pots banging and unfavorable situations in my house.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
When you say emotional, what does that mean?
I cried a lot, you know, screaming and crying.
What about what?
I don't know. Like, I guess it's probably less than I remember it, but in my memory.
Constantly?
Constantly. And
What? I don't fit in?
I don't fit in. Yeah.
Why did you guys bring me here?
Yeah. It was mostly inward, mostly wondering why I felt so horrible, no one liked me. And, it was why I went to punk shows. I hated my high school. I felt like I didn't fit in at all. And actually, there's this album by this band, The Bouncing Souls, called Maniacal Laughter. And it's one of the reasons I do my podcast, because I heard the album, and the album is like a punk album. It's fun. It's fun and great. But all the guy sings about is how much he hates himself and like being nervous around girls and then also like smashing toilets and stuff. And so like, it was this revelation for me where I was like, oh my God, you can like be sad and not be a jocky douche and like not want to like fuck all the girls and stuff, but then also like have friends and have fun. This is amazing. It was like,
you can have other angry, isolated, slightly hypersensitive friends.
Exactly.
Who don't know what to do with their feelings.
Yeah, totally. And you can be accepted. This isn't the entire world. The entire world isn't these like, these jocks and these tough guys and these girls who make fun of you and like, you know.
That was your experience?
Yeah, that's how I felt. If I look back, it wasn't everybody, but I felt very starkly that was the world.
And you were bullied?
I was bullied, yeah.
For what?
I don't know. You know?
Just being a wuss?
Being a wuss. That's totally what it was. It was for being a wuss. And in fairness, I was a wuss, man.
You shouldn't have to pay for being a wuss.
I agree. I totally agree.
It takes a while to become a proud wuss.
Yeah, it sure does. And I am a proud wuss.
Wuss proud.
I'm a wuss pride. Dude. Yeah. Hell yeah. Wuss. Devil horns, dog. I proudly admit that I cried a lot back then and that I cry a lot now. I don't care.
Not at school, though.
Hell no, not at school. No, man. Just like now, I don't cry at school. I don't cry in front of my friends now. I cry in my car after the show.
Oh. Do you cry after shows?
Every now and then. Every now and then I have a show that really hits me.
So like how fucked up did it get with your dad? Because he's like a military guy and you're this overly emotional wuss, we've determined.
But he's also a wuss, is the thing.
Oh.
My
latent wuss.
He's a he is a wuss that is the product of a non-wuss generation. Mm-hmm. I very much understand my father now, I feel like. And I hope he listens to this because he was angry when I was in high school.
At what?
And at his situation. He I don't exactly know. He was angry that his son was so goddamn emotional, I think.
Yeah.
He was, I think, angry.
At his rank?
He retired and went to teach at a high school where he's going to hate that I'm talking about this, by the way. He will probably listen to this, and I will get some shit.
He might not listen to it.
He also might not listen to it. Who knows?
He's only going to listen to it if you tell him about it.
That's true. So I'll just not do that.
Right. That's the way to go. I don't think you're being disrespectful. I think you're just trying to find a common ground.
I think I have, too. Like,
did you guys ever come to blows?
No, it got weird a couple times, for sure.
Like what, 9th, 10th, 11th?
I tried to run away when I was 15.
You did?
And
how long did you get away?
2 hours. And they were on it, man. They called all my friends. They got me.
What'd you do? Walk me through the day.
Okay, this will tell you how emotional I was in high school. Because it was a non-issue. It was my mother saying something dramatic and then me reacting dramatically to that. And I just wanted a fight. If I'm being honest, I just wanted to be someone. You know what? I just wanted to be a white kid who had more problems than he actually had. You know what I mean?
But also, like, if you actually do have detached parents for whatever reason, mine were a little selfish. Sometimes the only way to get their attention is to engage them in, you know, anger. Like sometimes when they get mad at you, it's part of you is like, no, you do care.
Actually, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, also makes for great stories, you know?
Well, you're not thinking that at the moment.
I don't know. Maybe I was. I don't really remember. You're right.
Well, what happened?
So it was like, maybe I was 16. It was building up. Like, I was...
Were you druggy?
I was not a druggie. I did not do drugs in high school. I went to shows. I didn't skip school. I was a good kid. I got straight A's, you know? I did what my parents told me, basically.
Yeah.
It was just like, okay, so my dad is someone who very much values respect. He's one of those, like, don't disrespect me guys. Yeah. And to the extent that if a friend of mine was wearing a hat in my house, he would, like, yell at them to take their hat off because it's disrespectful to wear a hat inside a house.
Mm.
And so that's, like, the level of intensity that it was at. And he would scream, take your hat off in my house. It was very much, and my friends would be like, oh my God, I didn't even know. And I'd be like, I'm sorry. It was really, this was a tense household, you know?
Was he a boozer?
No.
Nothing?
No.
Just pure anger?
Just very frustrated, yeah. And so I had a day, and I don't even remember what happened, but I was angry. And it was a weekend. Because I was hanging out with my friends all day, and we did the thing. I think we did all the things you do in a town where there's nothing to do. You know, we like went to the arcade.
Yeah.
We walked around the mall. We went bowling. Mm-hmm. We played mini golf. We went to the pool hall. You know what I mean?
Big day.
Yeah. Probably not all those things, but that's the list of things that we had available to us. We were at a pool hall, I remember, in Monroe, New York. And, I wasn't even smoking cigarettes yet at this point, you know? I'm like, I was behind the times. And
no, you're a smart kid.
Yeah, actually, yeah. So I was outside. I called my mom to ask if I could stay out an hour or two later with my friends. It was like 10 o'clock. And they were like, she was like, no, come home. And I was like, Mom, come on. I'm like 16. Yeah. Come on. Just let me stay
out.
I'm calling. Come on.
I'm not drinking.
Exactly. And she was like, no, come home. They were clearly mad at me. And I was like, give me a break. I said something like, God, what is this? Just let me.
No profanity.
I'm not going to kill anybody. Yeah. I'm sure maybe I cursed.
Uh-huh.
Because then she gets pushed over the edge somehow. And she's like, David, if you don't come home in the next hour, don't come home at all. And I was like, well, fine. Fuck it.
Yeah.
I'm not coming home at all. Which, like, that's, you know, is two idiots being dramatic, you know? And so I don't come home, and I go to one friend's house. My parents start calling all my friends, and, you know, where is he, where is he, where is he? I realize I'm at my friend Dan's house, Dan Kerrigan, who's now a stand-up.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I realize his mother's on the phone with my mother, and I, like, bolt out the door with my friend Bobby.
You're on the run.
I'm on the run. Yeah, yeah. Man. I go to Bobby's house, and then they find out I'm at Bobby's house. And
small town shit, man.
Yeah, absolutely, man. They
were ahead of you. One step ahead of you.
My dad just like races over to Bobby's house, and I'm basically trapped there because he lives at the end of East Shore Road, and there's nowhere to go after that.
That was the big standoff.
Yeah, totally.
No choppers involved.
And he's like walking up to the door, and I'm like, I'm just surrender, you know?
Yeah.
And it didn't help that Bobby's mom hated me. Uh-huh. Hated me because.
Turned you in immediately.
Yeah, she turned me in. And it, I mean, yeah, as you should if you're a parent, quite sure. Honestly.
Yeah.
But she especially, I think she took some joy in it because for two reasons. One, Bobby and I got caught stealing a street sign for Woodcock Mountain Road by the cops like 3 weeks before this.
That's got to get stolen a lot.
Yeah, yeah. It was plastic at this point. It was a plastic street. It wasn't even bolted in. And then, like a week after that, my friend Lewis, being hilarious, was over at Bobby's house.
Yeah.
And Bobby was Bobby's mom was bitching about how he got caught for the sign. And Lou was like, oh, that was all Dave's idea.
you're the criminal.
Totally.
So what happened? Did your dad beat you up?
No, but he did, on the drive home, I told him to fuck himself, which you just don't do to your dad, and you don't do to your military dad.
Mm-hmm.
Or really anybody, but he, and it's a tense situation, and he slams the brakes, pulls the car over, and he's like, you want to fight me? And he gets out of the car, tries to get me to get out of the car and fight him. And he's like smacking his hand on the door, and I'm like crying, just crying my eyes out, you know? And I'm like, why? I don't want to fight you. I don't want to fight you. And he gets back in the car and takes me home in silence. And yeah. And
well, it's interesting that he didn't discipline you physically, but he was looking for a fight after a certain point. Like he's not going to throw the first punch.
I don't think he would have fought me. Like, I think that it would have been like us looking at each other and him being like, is this what you wanted? You
know? Yeah.
Fucking fuck you or yeah. Whatever. I don't know.
Did he cuss?
No.
Yeah.
But again, in that moment, actually, I'm 100% sure he would never have hit me. For sure.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't even want to dream of like people thinking that about my dad because my dad is a really great guy. Yeah. He's like a very intensely good moralistic person,
right?
Who has a temper,
yeah.
And gets frustrated very easily,
right?
In that moment, it's like, yeah, that was real rough for me to deal with for a long time. That happening,
yeah.
I
wonder if this crying thing is somehow attributed to the only child business.
Maybe. Why? You think did you not cry much when you were a kid?
Well, not like, I don't like remember it being part of it. I mean, I'll cry now. Like I don't think I'm that adverse to crying, but like, I wouldn't cry after a show. Like it wasn't part of my rotation.
Sure.
You know,
really?
Yeah. As a high school kid, you know, I'd only cry if I was, you know, pushed, you know, to the point of it by my dad or something, but like, it was not something I did regularly.
Yeah, well, I don't mean to give the impression that it was so regular.
Can't back out now, crybaby. You're just a crybaby wuss. No turning that boat around.
That's true. The whole world knows now. The whole comedy scene is going to be like, look at this little bitch in this comedy show. Hey. That's the thing. I was backtracking to explain myself because of that worry. I'm still, even though I'm confident that it's okay, I like that I have a good cry sometimes. Yeah. I still am worried that people are going to bully me. I still have that thing in my head. I'm 31.
Well, it's weird. What do you mean? It's like men have a weird time with that. Mm-hmm. It's not specific to you. It's like, you know, because those same guys that that made us cry to begin with, they seem to define the cultural moment, mode.
Isn't that interesting? Because I've been thinking about this ever since I became aware of this horrific dynamic in the world.
I've cried on this show.
Have you?
Yeah. I mean, not, you know, sobbing, but, you know, I let my emotions happen. Like, you know, like I was in therapy today and I almost cried, but I stifled it. Why am I stifling my crying in front of my therapist? That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's the one place you should cry.
Absolutely. It's the place you go to cry. I don't know.
I cried a couple times in my last relationship.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I'll cry during the TV show. I'm very sensitive. Like, I'll cry when I'm talking to people sometimes. They won't see it, but I'll know. I'll feel it. Well, I'll feel it in my soul. And I was watching TV last night, and I actually got choked up at weird moments, too. They, you know, not the moments that you would think they would be.
You know, that's the thing that's been happening to me. I have like probably 3-4 good like actual event emotional cries a year, but I cry from watching TV and movies commercials all the time.
Yeah, me too. And I don't mind that. You know, I've always been that way. But crying properly in you know, just
like
letting
weeping.
Just letting yourself do it, you know, is the tricky thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, you can get teared up and then like,
Yeah.
But to actually like, just open the dam, you know, I don't do that too often.
It's tough. And actually, my dad is a big reason why I'm like this about crying, why I do it a lot and why I'm okay with it. Because my mother says, at least, that when I was very young, I started crying. I don't know how old.
Mm-hmm.
Old enough to not be a baby. And I was crying about something, and my mom was like, don't cry. And my dad stopped her and was like, no, let him cry. My father never let me cry. So that'll tell you what his upbringing was like. And
that's one of those weird kind of keys in.
Yeah.
You know, like one of those weird windows into when you hear someone like that, you're like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah. There's another moment with my dad that was really interesting where ever since I was self-aware, I've known that my baseline of self-loathing is that I think no one likes me for sure. Mm. I obsess over it all day. I can find evidence in any conversation. To this day, I'm way better about it now.
Yeah.
Especially with therapy, I've like learned the patterns of it and I can get out of it like more easily. But I've known that about myself for a while. And when I was like 21 or 22, I was staying at my grandmother's house for Christmas and my mom and dad were there. It was Christmas dinner. Everyone had left except myself and my parents. And my grandmother loved to drink and was hilarious when she was drunk. She's
my mom?
Dad's mom. We called her Nanny. She was great. And so my dad goes out to buy my mom cigarettes or something. And my vodka drunk grandma says to my mother, what is Scotty's deal? He didn't call his sisters today. He didn't call his brothers. He doesn't call anybody. He doesn't call anyone. He doesn't let people know that he loves them. What is wrong with him? And my mom says, not thinking I was in the room, well, Abby, you know, Scotty has always sort of felt like no one likes him. And I was like, whoa,
yeah.
No way, dude. My grandmother being adorable, my dad gets home and she walks right up to him, drunk as a skunk, and says, Scotty, everyone likes you. And he was like, well, what? And he was just rattled, you know?
Yeah.
And it's also like my grandfather, apparently he was always very nice and calm and quiet to me, but apparently hit my grandmother, and my father was at odds with him for a while. And
like regularly or once?
Regularly, apparently. And
God damn it. It's so insane to be able to track the psychological reactions that define families.
Absolutely.
Because whatever the hell is going on there, whether she was, you know, loaded or what, that, you know, when you have an abusive relationship, a physically abusive relationship, and you grow up in that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, then you're just going to, like, there's, in my experience as a non-professional person, I'm not a therapist or anything, but when you grow up in that kind of chaos, you know, there's no way you're not going to come out a control freak or a fucking abuser.
Sure.
There's only two ways to go. It sounds like your dad went the control freak route.
Absolutely. Well, and it's a major reason why I respect my father so much. It's like he didn't talk to my grandfather for a long time. And to come out of that as someone who's like, no, let him cry, as irritable and like fighting you on the street as you could get, it's like impressive. You know what I mean?
Wow.
So
I bet you the military was a way for him to sort of, you know, have some like control and discipline in his life.
Yeah. Also, I think he's probably a little bit of a masochist because he's like insanely liberal in the military, you know?
Yeah.
I can't imagine how that was. Like that raises the desire to control your life to a new level, you know?
Well, I would say sort of like, you know, shamelessly and supportingly letting your son cry is that in and of itself is an amazingly progressive idea for a military man.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. He fucked with me too when I was young. I did something wrong when I was like 16 or 17. And he was like, get down and give me 20. And I was like, what? And he's like, do it. And I was like, ah. And I did it. And he was like, ah. And he was like, you don't have to.
He didn't even follow through with it.
He was just
trying that out.
Yeah.
He's going to try to be the great Santini.
I think for one action.
Well,
that's the other thing. My dad's like a sass mouth, you know, when he's not screaming irritable.
But it wasn't competitive.
No.
That's good.
Yeah.
Because that's a dynamic between fathers and sons that stinks.
It's not competitive. Yeah, it's more of like our dynamic that was bad was that he, well, like me, like I said, in any conversation, I can find any evidence that the person doesn't like me.
Really?
Any, man. Like,
what, did it happen here? Is it happening now?
No, actually, this is great.
Okay.
Yeah. But I have had that with you before.
Well, everybody has that with me. I don't know why. Sometimes I know why, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's very few people I don't like, but initially I'm generally annoyed or threatened. So so my reaction to that is going to appear like I don't like somebody.
Sure. Well, I can tell you about when we first met, and it was like that. You had a beard, right? I did have a beard.
Yeah. What happened?
And this is why, you remember at the beginning of this podcast, which is this recording, I was like, you had me on! And you were like, wow, contentious right from the beginning. Because of this first interaction with you, I've always been a little combative with you. It was Holy Fuck.
Yeah.
And it was the first time you'd done it, and it was like the fifth or sixth
one. You hosted at the movie theater.
Yes. And it got really good.
Yeah.
But at its inception, it was a stand-up show run by me, who'd been doing stand-up for like 6 months.
Right.
In a theater that seats 250.
Yeah.
Cavernous, huge ceilings. Terrible idea to run a show there.
Yeah. It's always hard to do comedy in movie theaters.
Absolutely. And I was a huge fan of yours, and you said yes, and I was really stoked.
Yeah.
But then it also happened to be, like, literally the first show we had, because since I was young in stand-up, I hadn't burned all my bridges with my friendships yet, so I had, like, a shitload of my friends from jobs and school come to the first four or five shows.
Yeah.
So, good crowd right out of the gate. Your show was the first show I had with a shitty crowd.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, no, you gotta be kidding me, man. And it was raining too. And I'll never forget it too. Yeah, you showed up and you were like, hey, are you Dave? And I was like, yeah, what's up? Thanks for doing the show. And you were like, how's it looking in there? And I was like, it's kind of light. And you were like, I fucking knew it, man. And I was like, oh, God damn it. Fucking, you gotta be kidding me, man.
Now Marin's gonna lose it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, I went inside, people weren't showing up, and I came out, and I came up to you.
Comics weren't showing up,
and the comics who were on the show were there, but audience was not coming. I had, like, lost all my goodwill with my friends in the rain, and we were just fucked. There were, like, 10 people in a 200-seat theater, you know?
Was it that small?
It was maybe a little more.
Just that lower tier, maybe.
Yeah, in the front.
Yeah.
And I came out to tell you something. I was like, hey, so I just wanted to tell you. And you were like, I fucking knew it. And I was like, what? You were with your girlfriend at the time. And you were like, I was telling her on the way over here that at some point the producer's going to come up to me. And he's going to be like, normally we have more people here. And for some reason this time we don't have as many. And I fucking knew you were going to tell me that. And I literally said, no, I was just going to tell you that we're going to start around 9:30 instead of 9. And you were like, oh, all right. Fine.
Really? That's what I said all right to?
Yeah.
I must have been mad about something else.
I was really, I was like, man, fuck.
I think I get in the weird zone where, like, you get asked to do so many shows, so many comic-produced shows, which is fine, but at some point you realize, like, well, it's good for them to have me on. Like, and I don't know, like, I know a lot of people like my comedy and stuff, but it's also good promotion. I know how that shit works.
Sure, yeah.
But, like, a lot of times, like, and I don't mind performing for small crowds, but at certain points, I get tired. Like, I'm a little more picky about which small shows I do, just because, you know, like, if I know it's going to be what it's going to be, it's fine. But I think that was the first time. And I think what had happened was everyone had told me what a great show it was.
Yeah.
And I think that's what that sounds like. And I was probably up the wall with her. because I always was.
Right.
But I do think it was probably sort of like a lot of people are like, no, it's great, it's great, it's great. Because it doesn't add up that I would go, I knew it, unless somebody had told me that was a good show.
Right. Like they were, I knew they were fucking with me.
Something. Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, yeah. Right. Like it's like, I'm going to go do this show at the movie theater. Like it was, to me, it was already like, how good could it be?
It's just a show. I never heard of this guy.
It's at a movie theater.
You know, I've been thinking about, because I was coming over here to do this show, I was thinking about it. And like, I think that there are, you didn't remember that interaction we had at all, right? I would imagine.
Not completely, no.
And I would imagine.
But I don't remember last week.
Sure. Well, there's that too. Yeah. I got a terrible memory. But I think that there's like, when a comedian is a really young comic and hasn't like found themselves as a social presence in the comedy scene, I think that there's a lot of weirdness that happens. And like, I was pretty young, and I'll bet you that I was pretty weird as a young comic. Like, I remember Todd Glass yelling at me on the phone once when I was really young because I was so nervous around him. I looked up to him so much. There are all these times that I don't remember of me being weird to big comics that I looked up to. But then also, then there are all these instances that I have with these big comedians that they don't remember because they didn't think anything of me at the time.
I remember registering that you were funny at some point.
Well, that's good.
Which is not always easy for me to do.
Sure.
You know, because I just can't, like, it's hard to get through to me sometimes because a lot of times young comics, they're just trying too hard or they're just not quite doing themselves yet. They're just doing something. It's like, it's something that's familiar. It's not, to me, it's not like I know who that guy is.
Yeah.
There's the familiar cadence of a fellow telling jokes he wrote. You know what I mean?
Sure, yeah.
But I also think with us, you know, my generation, it's like this whole easy access, 1,000 shows, guys have been doing it 6 months, calling themselves comedians. You know, it was sort of a big transition to make.
Okay.
And that, you know, at some point, the comedy scene that you grew up in was really built on comic run shows.
Yeah.
The entire paradigm is different.
Oh, interesting.
So like, you know, when we came up, we all know each other. You know, there's different levels of clickiness, but, you know, we were all built around this old comedy club model.
Yeah.
So like all you guys, there's this huge community of comedians that have been doing it 2 weeks that have their own rooms, that have their, you know, and then at some point, you know, you got tired. I'm talking about your generation of just rotating, you know, a bunch of people who are trying to develop, you know, through your rooms. And at some point somebody started like, well, why don't we just call those big guys?
Yeah.
And then everyone realized how easy it was. And then you're like, oh, that guy, he didn't even question anything. He just said, sure, he'll come down. So they got to be pretty easy to get. They're just sitting around doing nothing. And it turns out
that was a cool realization that I had. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It turns out it's generally true. Like if we're not working a night, you know, we always feel half guilty because most of us started out trying to do comedy every night.
Yeah.
At least one set. So like, you know, we get older and it's sort of like, it's not as imperative as it used to be, or we don't really know where to go, or we don't. So we get the call and it plays on our guilt. We're like, I probably should just go do a set.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you've got all the biggest comics around, you know, you guys have access.
Yeah.
And it's easy to get a hold of us. And I think that one of the things that registers with us is that if there's ever a moment where someone like Todd Glass or myself gets mad, it's like, I think we have a deep need to be like, you know, me and you aren't the same.
Yeah. Really?
You know, like, you know, you do know that we're at a different level, you know, here.
And let me tell you that we know.
Yeah.
It's an ever-present thought. I mean, hence the combativeness. You know, it's like...
But I did the same thing. Everybody has their... You got to keep your cool. You know what I mean? You don't want to be too gracious or too, like, you know, like, appreciative or even if it's that. But then I also think that, you know, bottom line is we're all comics, but I think that you're going to get a... You know, some of us are a little prickly at times.
Sure.
So where did you start?
I started here. I mean, the first time I ever did stand-up was in Fresno, California.
I don't even know what Fresno is. It's like this weird punchline.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is.
And what is Fresno?
It's like the Alabama of California.
It is?
Well, as far as making jokes about locations. It is right in the middle of California. It's 3 hours north of LA.
Is it inland?
It's inland. It's like in the middle from the east, the west, the north, and
is
the
it
south.
Cowboy land?
Yeah.
Right.
Farms.
Right.
Desert. 118 degree summers.
Yeah.
And also frat boys and gangs. It is tough.
Yeah.
I lived there. I was a radio DJ there for 2 years after college. And
professional.
Yes.
That was your thing.
That was what I was going for, it, man.
Music?
Yeah. I was a DJ at 103.7 KRZR, The Wild Hare in Fresno, California. But H-A-R-E.
What'd you go to college for?
I have a degree in psychology.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, I didn't know what the fuck was going on.
Were you engaged in that, or was that just a sort of like, psychology?
It was that. It was, my girlfriend's doing this.
Right.
That's okay. Literally what it was. And I was interested in it by the end. I'm glad I did it. It was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a college.
How does it serve you?
Well, for one, it makes me more self-obsessive. Mm-hmm. So that sucks.
So you have a long list of reasons why you think people don't like you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even more. Yeah, it just is more maddening. Because a bachelor's in psychology is like going to psychology high school.
Right.
There's no focus. You relearn a lot of the same information, and you're memorizing dates and names and stuff. And you learn about what the diseases are, but not how to treat or learn about them.
Right.
You know? Yeah, it just like let me know about all of these phenomena that I could obsess over.
But you were looking for a career in radio.
Yeah. Okay. So my senior year of college was weird. It went like this. I smoked a lot of heroin. That's real. And
when did you get? You didn't do any drugs in high school.
And then I started doing drugs in college. And then I did every drug. And then by the end, I was smoking heroin like
the
a couple
tar?
Times a week. Yeah, tar.
That was around.
Yeah. Well, I had a friend that I think was shooting it up.
Ugh.
And he, I think, I don't know.
So you're smoking off the foil with the straw?
Yeah. Yeah. Have you done that?
Yeah.
He like
doesn't seem as bad that way.
It doesn't seem as bad that way. And it started, he like put it on a bowl of weed and was like, you want to smoke some opium?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. And then we did it 3 times and he was like, this is heroin. And I was like, you know, just like an after school special, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, totally. I'm already in. It's already great. It already hasn't ruined my life. So I'll do this 3 times a week for a year and a half.
It's still not every day.
It wasn't every day. I didn't get addicted or dope sick. I never went to rehab. I was so scared of getting addicted that I never...
So 3 times a week was manageable for you.
Yeah, totally.
I'm only smoking heroin three times a week.
An adult's heroin addiction.
At the same time every week.
Exactly, yeah. In the morning, in order to get through the day. And so I was like finishing up my year of school and psychology, and then I had a radio show. And then
in college?
At the college radio station at... KSCR, which is KXSC now.
And you were playing what?
Well, I was like, I would play punk music and reggae and some other weird shit that I liked, but really I would fuck around and I don't know, I would like freestyle rap sometimes and just like do dumb bits, like read.
So by college, had you found a crew of people that you could hang out with?
You know, yes and no. Like, I don't hang out with a lot of the people I hung out with in college because...
But I mean, as a kid who was isolated and always in a strange land and a crying wuss, by the time you got to college, that's a time where people can, like, there's a lot of people. You're like, all right, those are my people. Did you have people?
Actually, by my senior year of high school, I did. I had a crew at my senior year of high school that I was really close to. And that was where I started being funny because they were really funny.
Right.
To this day, funniest people I've ever met in my life. And we would just sit around... and drink beer and talk shit about each other.
It's amazing once drugs and alcohol come into it, how things loosen up a little bit.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, you start being a little less afraid,
yeah.
Crying a little less.
Yeah.
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 It's like a warm blanket, you know?
Yeah, it is. Sure it is.
Yeah. And then I had a crew throughout college for sure. And then college just ended. I didn't even know what happened. I was like, oh, crap, man.
You're on heroin.
Yeah, totally. It was so embarrassing. Oh, man. I both hope and don't hope my parents listen to this.
They're not going to listen to it unless you tell them.
They will find it.
Do they look for it?
I don't know. I actually don't know.
It'll be a while. You can think it through.
Yeah, it'll be some years.
But you're not strung out, and you're still a good kid. You still barely cuss.
I'm fine. I also don't do drugs
and
anymore.
You're very diplomatic, and you're pleasant, and you have good manners. I mean, they have a lot to be proud of.
Well, thank you, Mark.
Yeah, just so because you smoked heroin 3 times a week doesn't mean you were a drug addict. It was just 3 times a week consistently, yeah, but not
true.
Addicted.
That's true. That's true. Not addicted, just regularly. Regularly freebasing heroin off of tinfoil in
you're
my
not
house.
Freebasing. Don't call it that.
Isn't that what freebasing is?
No.
Okay. Well, so
you're smoking heroin. You're smearing it on a piece of tinfoil and
I was putting dots of black tar heroin onto ripped off pieces of tinfoil.
I think it's called foiling or chasing the dragon.
Chasing the dragon.
Freebasing, I think, is actually it's breaking down coke to its purest form and then smoking it.
So
it's actually, I think freebasing is the word for the process of
of
taking, you know, shitty coke,
cooking it down.
Okay. And then smoking the pure coke.
So that's why crack is called base? Is
right.
Okay.
Because that's based coke.
Okay. Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
Learning. I'm yeah. learning.
Yeah. There you go.
I can't believe I didn't know that.
Maybe you should start freebasing.
I should.
Now that you've been miscalling your heroin addiction freebasing, maybe it's time you learned about freebase.
I've been lying all these years, so I should just do the freebase.
Right.
So I'm not a liar.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. See where that takes you at this point in your life.
This has been a really productive afternoon.
Helpful, I think.
So when I was an idiot and I was thinking about going to grad school, I sent
for heroin?
For heroin. Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to get an MH. I sent out for my college transcripts.
Yeah.
I got them. And my GPA, my final GPA was a 2.99,
yeah,
which is unbelievable with the way that I acted in college, like that I even got that high. But it's so close to
your
a 3.0.
Your parents taught you well.
Yeah.
3.0 is the highest, right?
No, 4.0 is the highest.
Oh, yeah.
So
not great then.
3.0 is like means that you did fine. You're like a
right.
good student,
right.
kind of. At 2.99. And then I looked at my GPA, and then I remembered, oh, right. My senior year of college, second semester senior year, commencement's coming up. It's 2 weeks from graduation. I dropped a class to do heroin. I dropped it so late that it wasn't like a withdrawal. A 0 averaged in on my GPA.
Right.
So had I not dropped this class, I would have gotten over a 3.0,
mm-hmm.
and the class I dropped.
See where heroin took you?
Yeah.
It took you to 2.99.
I know. God, I'm such a
which is
a
not
loser.
Jail or death. So you should. Don't ever tell that heroin story ever. Yeah, it got bad, man. I lost like a percentage, a tenth of a point.
No, but the class I dropped was soccer. I dropped soccer class.
Can't play heroin on soccer.
Can't play
soccer on heroin.
Heroin
and you can't play heroin
better than
on soccer. Either way, that works.
I'm just saying, like, I mean, it was like ridiculous the way that I was conducting myself. Like, yeah, yeah.
But as far
fuck
as
my life.
As far as what could have happened,
I guess, yeah, you're right.
You know, it's good. It's sort of
my rock bottom at 2.99 was not that bad. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, it's like it's good for family listening. Your rock bottom is okay for families to listen.
Absolutely.
To. I like that. So you finished it. Now you just drink and smoke weed or what?
I smoke weed every now and then, yeah.
Yeah, but nothing too out of control?
I was smoking it to sleep for a couple of years.
Yeah.
But I don't do that anymore either. So,
you start out DJing.
Yeah.
After college. You like it. You thought, like, you want a career in radio.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened?
So I did like it, and I...
It's great to be on these kind of mics.
It is. It's great. Man, and being on the radio, I always loved the radio. I listen to the radio all the time. I loved it.
Yeah.
And the thing is that radio nowadays,
I know,
you know, it's dying, and there's no reason to have a DJ in there because you go into work at, I would go into work as a radio DJ, and my whole shift would be programmed in. All the songs are in there. I don't pick anything. So.
Yeah, it's sad.
It is sad. And. There's a thing called voice tracking, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
No. Nope.
Oh, you're not? Okay. So voice tracking.
I did only talk radio.
Oh, okay. You can, all those songs and commercial breaks and everything are programmed in. And so you can go in before your shift and
do
record,
the wraparounds.
Do it all, record it in, and you're done. And if you do that, you get paid an hour's worth of pay for 6 hours of airtime. So now there are a lot of stations that are voice tracked almost completely, and they have an entirely part-time staff that makes like $10 an hour.
Yeah, and it's not personality driven anymore, and also like that world. Even then, how competitive that market is to sort of hold listeners and to get on a station that.
Oh yeah,
you know, it's difficult.
I got friends that are incredible, like hilarious radio DJs who are struggling. My friend Rick Rodham, who I met there. One of the funniest people I've ever met. And he's a radio DJ, and he's in some tiny town in Texas, you know?
Just struggling.
And,
oh, it's fucking hard.
Yeah.
It's so sad because, like, we found podcasts, thank God.
Yeah.
And, you know, now that's there. And
yeah.
You're going to do better than being on a small station that maybe you're pulling 25,000 people, maybe.
Your reach is just so much wider. And if you get on, even, do you know how those XM guys do? Is that pretty big?
No. There's a few big shows on XM. But you really just, you know, you're another guy in a studio in the hallway.
Right.
And like, you know, a lot of the people on XM, I think, brought listeners to XM.
Yeah.
Like they left jobs where they had built followings. I really don't know what the metrics are, but, you know, like Stern does well and some of the music stations does well and the sports do well. But in terms of like, do they make money? No, because I don't think it's advertising driven, and I don't think their contract salary, depending on who they are, is that big. So I don't know what determines it.
Oh, yeah, it's subscription based, right?
Yeah. So, like, you go to Sirius in New York, and it's just this big facility, and there's just studios everywhere.
Right.
Everyone's doing their little show.
Right. And, like, how do you. I'm sure they know exactly how many people are listening to
every
show.
I think Ron and Fez do well, and I think, you know, Stern does well. I think Stern's channel, some of them do well.
Bubba the Love Sponge probably does really well.
I don't know how much he holds. I don't know that Sirius necessarily was a successful venture all around, because I think the idea that it would be in every car or that it would be appealing for people to have at home, I don't know if that panned out.
Right. Well, because it's not in every car.
No, it's not. Certainly not in every home.
Yeah.
So you do it for a couple of years and you get disenchanted?
Absolutely. And it was weird how, because I was, you know, I was the sidekick on the night show, and I just like became obsessed and was in there all the time, and I ended up having my own weekend shifts and doing stunts on the afternoon show and like second chair on the night show.
Yeah.
But I always wanted to play what I wanted, and then finally I like proposed a show and they gave it to me, and I got this show like after I'd been there for a year and a half. Literally, I opened it up to the listeners to suggest names, and the name I landed on, this is by the way an active rock station, so we played like Pantera, Jimi Hendrix, Metallica,
right,
all Disturbed, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the name of my show was The Fight After Church. Still one of the best named things I've ever done.
Yeah.
It was great. It was an hour, 11 to midnight Monday to Friday, and I played metal and punk rock and B-sides from bands that we play. And when I started doing that, I did it for like 6 months, and doing that was so validating that it just canceled everything else I was doing. Doing a regular shift wasn't the same, even though like it's all pre-programmed, and because of that, my program director, this guy E. Curtis Johnson, who I hope to thank from a podium someday, like really... really helped push me forward into comedy. Like he was like, well, since you're not programming the station, you got to be funny, give stuff away, do bits, play games, be funny, talk to callers, just like be a personality. Even though I was doing that, by the end of running my own show where I played my own shit, I just couldn't handle playing like Linkin Park and stuff. I just couldn't take it anymore. And you combine that with the fact that the station was a Clear Channel station.
It always comes down to pride. I can't play this shit. Not on my watch.
Yeah, I remember, too, being in... And there's, like, there was some drama crap that happened at the hands of the major corporation I worked for. But I was in there some like Sunday doing my noon to four shift. And I look up at the program computer, and the playlist was something like Linkin Park... Oh, also, we had just realized in a new like ratings book. I don't even know. We sort of found out that the 18 to 34 or 24 demographic had shrunk immensely in Fresno, and 24 to 45 or 35 to 54 had gotten way bigger.
Yeah.
So we were gonna play stuff that appealed to them, and so I looked at this playlist, and the playlist was like Linkin Park, Korn, Nirvana, which I love, and then Dio. Mm-hmm. And I saw it and I was like, man, what the fuck? You got to be kidding me. Now I'm playing Linkin Park and Dio. I'm fucking out of here, dude.
You got your principles. But yeah, you were probably, but also I imagine the pressure of dealing with a Queer Channel outlet and the, you know, kind of trying to honor how they spin those fucking Arbitron ratings.
Absolutely. Book.
It's just like, it's a fucking nightmare.
Well, and Queer Channel fucked us, Rick and me in particular, and me twice. They were just doing dirty shit. Like it was a 9 or 10 station cluster. They in 90 or 91 had bought a smooth jazz station and the two guys who had founded it worked there and were the DJs there. And then while I was there in 2004 or 5, they flipped it to a country station and fired the guys who founded it. And that's just cold, man. That's just dirty. They didn't even give them a chance. They didn't even give them another job. They're just like, fuck you. Get out of here. You founded a station. Thanks for the
that
station.
Day, they that let them do their shift.
Get the fuck out.
Pack your boxes.
Yeah. And they were firing people that were like tenured, had worked, had kids, had worked there for 20 years. It was gross. And so Rick Rodham and I... we're working together a lot at this point. I was doing stuff on his show and he had been doing afternoons there for like 5 years. And he was like, you know what? It's time for me to move up to mornings. That's like the big dog at a radio station like that. Afternoons is like second best. Right. And then morning is the big thing. Cause you just talk, there's no music. So he like we had our own morning show that had been there for like 15 or 20 years that people loved, but they were kind of on their way out. And Rick really felt that way. So he made a proposal for his morning show. And the morning show was going to be him. I was going to sit second chair. And then our intern, our stunt guy, would be this dude, Manhole.
Yeah.
Who is still a DJ at this
with
station.
That name?
Fresno. Manhole. Okay. I think he's just Drew now.
Okay, but, good.
Yeah.
You don't want Manhole to stick for your whole life.
I know,
life.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, maybe he does. Yeah. So he... puts this proposal forth. They accept it. Rick tells me, like, we haven't signed anything, but they told me for sure we're going to be the new morning show. And it's like 3 months from now. The day comes. I'm working my day job. He calls me at work and they're like, yeah, we just had a meeting. They fired the morning show and they're syndicating Man Cow out of Chicago.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And by the way, it panned in Fresno. It bombed so hard,
you
Man
need
Cow.
Local morning show. That was their big idea to syndicate morning shows. And morning shows, people want to hear about the neighborhood.
Exactly. About the old Coke factory that blew up or whatever. So Rick loses his mind. And Rick is like a very intense person when he's angry.
Yeah.
I went over to his house that night. And he was wasted. And he tells me, he's like, Dave, tomorrow we're going to do one of two things. Either I'm going to go into work and I'm going to quit, or you're going to go into work and you're going to operate the board while I do a live remote pissing on the general manager's dead wife's grave. And I was like, do the first one. that second one is evil. And he did the first one. He quit. And so there's this weird power vacuum where there's myself. I'm part-time. They were keeping me at 30 hours a week, so I couldn't get a raise or benefits.
Yeah.
Because Clear Channel's garbage. Manhole, who's also doing shifts. Big Snacks, another friend of mine.
Yeah. How's he doing, Big Snacks?
He's doing great, man.
Good.
Talked to him the other day. Yeah. I think he's some sort of security manager in Fresno. He's good. Coyote, who ran the night show.
Yeah.
And we're all like vying, right? And I quit my day job because I figured, screw it, man. At least I could be the afternoon DJ for 2 months. And I was. Everyone else had a job, so I was just the afternoon DJ while they were looking for someone else. Super fun. So fun. Manhole hears that I quit my day job, assumes that that means that I got the job, quits in like a fury live on the air. I don't even know what he said, but he was like, I quit. Like runs, calls me to congratulate me. And I was like, dude, I didn't get the job. And on the phone, he was like, oh no. And so he's gone. And then so it's me and Coyote and Snacks and Ashton and someone else. And then after 3-4 months of that, they hire the afternoon guy from the other rock station in town and just fuck over everyone who works at the station, you know?
And that was the end?
And that was the end. And that was it. Like, I sort of, like, bided my time a little bit And I was like, and yeah, and then I wasn't feeling good about the music. And literally, my last break on air was me going on a socialist rant about how major corporations are ruining the country. But I was just leaving because I was pissed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Might as well make it big.
Yeah, totally.
And then you came down here?
And then I came back down here, moved in with some friends, got a job doing some, like, web bullshit.
Yeah.
And was drunk for a while. Well, okay, so actually, at the end of being a radio DJ, I knew I was going to leave. Rick and some other people had tried stand-up. I tried it. I hated it. I mean, I loved it, but I hated it. I was so afraid. After my first set, I had drank a whole bottle of Jack Daniels, and I got in an argument with a woman about Jesus. It was at the end of a music open mic in Fresno, California. I bombed, got in an argument with a woman about Jesus. My friends tell me that apparently a guy heckled me, and I said back, "Oh, yeah? Nice shirt." That's what I said.
Yeah.
I was drunk. I cried after that set.
Yeah.
And I was like, fuck this. And then I did it a few more times in that year. After
you were hooked.
I was hooked, but I was also afraid.
Yeah.
I moved back to L.A., did it like probably five times total in 2006. Too afraid. I would hate going up. I would shake on stage.
For a month, you'd be thinking about it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Like trying to write new jokes for every set and just like being at an open mic and dreading them calling my name. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
Yeah. And
I'd forgotten that, but yeah, I remember.
It's horrible.
You're on the list and you're like, I'm on the list.
Get me off that list.
It's going to happen.
It's horrible. I don't want to do this. I remember being at the Comedy Store open mic and a dude coming up to me and being like, hell yeah, man, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Can't wait. And I was like, I just want to get this shit over with.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And he goes, why are you doing it then? I think that was the last set I did. Because I was he's right. Why am I doing this? I hate this. And I was afraid for 3 years, and then I started.
And then you felt better about it?
Well, you know, I had something help me start. My friend Julie Cohen, who's still one of my best friends, when I tried it in 2006, she tried it and stuck with it. And she has since quit. It's not her thing. She wants to write and make movies.
Right.
But she 3 years in was running an open mic, fired her co-host.
Yeah.
And this whole 3 years, she had been bothering me every now and then to go to a mic with her. And I would make up an excuse like, oh, I got stuff to do. I was afraid. So she basically just like called me a coward until I was like, fine, I'll co-host your open mic with you.
Yeah, you crying wuss.
Yeah, you little bitch.
Yeah.
Everyone knows you're a little bitch, you little bitch. Uh-huh. And so I, like that might have even been what she said. And I co-hosted the open mic with her. It started in March of 2009. And every Sunday until August of 2009, I co-hosted with her. Didn't do a set, didn't do jokes, just like tried to be funny, bringing people on and off stage. And doing that, I was nervous and I would shake and stuff, but there wasn't the pressure of like the laughter.
Right.
So doing that sort of like worked the demons out of me.
Eased you in.
Eased me into it.
Yeah.
And then around in August of 2009, Julie, without telling me, just booked me on a show and then told me I was on the show and that I had to do it. And so I started going to mics. And this time I went to Vance Sanders and Robert Yasumura's Tuesday mic at Westwood Bruco. I went up, I bombed, and it was awesome. I was like, this is awesome. I had like a much more positive outlook on it. And I was like, I'm doing this every day. This is the fucking best. And then I was like,
I was
hooked. I went up every day, 3-4 times a day if I could.
Yeah.
That was great. Yeah. That's how I...
And now, like, where's the career at? You're opening for Kyle. You got the Terrified podcast on the Nerdist Network or no?
On Nerdist, yeah. Yeah, things are going really well. I'm really happy. I just got back from a 2-month tour, which was the first real tour I ever did. It was so fun. Part of that was opening for Kyle. A lot of it was headlining small alt rooms and bar shows myself. Weird showcases in New York and I did every type of show. I got back, I headlined the Improv for the first time, which was like incredible that they asked me to do that. And I don't know. I just feel great about stand up. It's weird.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's been quite a journey for a 31-year-old man.
Had you talked to me 2 months ago before I left for the tour, this would be a very different conversation.
Well, you were booked and we rescheduled, so I'm glad we got it to this day.
Me too, because I literally would have been like, Mark, I don't know what the fuck, I'm going to fucking don't know, man.
And you know what, buddy? You're going to feel that way again.
2 days from now.
Well, yeah. It was good talking to you.
Yeah, you too.
All right, that was good. That was I enjoyed talking to him. I was happy that Paulie stopped by. I feel punchy and giddy. Go to WTFpod.com. Do some business there. I think we're going to restock the merch for Christmas. Things are happening. I think I do better when I'm tired. Fuck the edge. Boomer lives!